Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When the big biography of Bob Fosse, the director and choreographer, landed in the Soundcheck office, we all looked at the title, Fosse, and thought the same thing. Holy cow, that book's enormous. And I think we were all remembering this scene from The Birdcage.
He's chewing gum.
Chewing gum helps me think.
Sweetie, you're wasting your gum.
Let me do this, Albert.
Fine, you're the director.
Thank you.
This is a complex number full of mythic themes.
I don't think I get it.
Try more gum.
Albert.
I hear you.
Thank you, I know you do. Celsius, you have to explore it. But let's start with the premise that when you see this stunning, smoldering creature, she transcends your desire to chew. She electrifies you. You do an eclectic celebration of the dance. You do Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. You do Martha Graham, Martha Graham, Martha Graham. Or Twyla, Twyla, Twyla. Or Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd, Michael Kidd. Or Madonna, Madonna, Madonna. But you keep it all inside.
Fosse, Fosse, Fosse. Man, when you're important enough that you can just be a moment in a Robin Williams routine, that's big. We'll find out how Bob Fosse got to be such a cultural touchstone in a moment. We've also got live music from a Colorado-based chamber pop band. They're called Princess Music, and I intend to find out why. Also, cochlear implants have helped many deaf people hear. But they can't hear music, at least not as we would recognize it. We'll learn why and hear about some promising new developments that might let folks with cochlear implants actually hear all that jazz. That's later on Soundcheck.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz.
Just hearing the opening strains of that song for several generations of Americans will conjure up a set of dance moves, the thrusting hips, the turned-in knee, and, of course, the jazz hands. When Bob Fosse introduced these moves into musicals, on stage and on screen, they were revolutionary. And Fosse changed forever the way America dances. That's according to Sam Wasson, author of a comprehensive and critically acclaimed new biography called simply Fosse. Sam, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, thank you.
So there is a generation of Americans who won't be familiar with Fosse and the turned-in knee and the jazz hands and all that kind of stuff because he's been dead for over a quarter century.
Yeah, he died in 1987, which surprises a lot of people because those of us who do remember Fosse have such a strong image of him that it's almost like he hasn't really left.
So, but he wasn't on screen a whole lot except maybe early in his career. So, you know, there are a lot of people who will maybe know the name and won't know why this guy is worth, Sam, 800 pages.
750-something, maybe, or 30-something.
It weighs 800 pages.
Yeah. Well, it's a big font.
Mm-hmm. why is he, you know, why is he so critical to an understanding of, like, American pop culture, theater, musicals?
That is the question. I mean, he revolutionized every medium that he influenced. Most great artists, I mean, if they're lucky, they revolutionize one. But Fosse was kind of like this Orson Welles or Noel Coward talent. He was omnivorous. I mean, television, film, stage, dance. Obviously, there's overlap between mm-hmm. those media, but in each respect, Fosse left an imprint, and that's just unbelievable. It's just a giant talent.
So, do we remember him mostly for his choreography? Because he was also a director.
Yep.
And a dancer, and
I think the choreography. I think the choreography is probably the first thing that pops into a person's mind when they think about Fosse.
So, what were his signature moves?
Well, You described it perfectly when you opened up. I mean, we're talking about hip thrusts. We're talking about splayed hands. These are symbols of dance's past, of showbiz's past. You know, those open up hands, they come from the Al Jolson tradition, which comes from the minstrelsy tradition. So there's a historical precedent for almost every move that Fosse appropriated.
Mm. And like many great artists, you use the word appropriated, he didn't just make stuff up out of whole cloth. He took stuff that was sort of bubbling up under the surface and sort of codified it and made something distinctive out of
it. Right. I mean, that's one of the things that I love about Fosse. He really was a collage artist, and he's using a conversation that's a part of American history.
Now, you say in the book at one point that Fosse, actually you say this pretty early on, that Fosse revolutionized the movie musical twice. Mm. Would the first one be Kiss Me, Kate?
No. No. Although Kiss Me, Kate is the first time we see Bob Fosse in a movie musical, and it's the first time we see Fosse dance in a movie musical. So in that sense, it kind of was maybe...
So maybe there are three.
Maybe there are three, yeah. But what I had in mind were Cabaret, the film, and All That Jazz.
Okay. So in Cabaret, we have, you know, Liza Minnelli singing the title song. Let's hear a little bit of this.
What good is sitting alone in your room? Come hear the music play. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Put down the knitting, the book and the broom. It's time for a holiday. Life is a cabaret, old chum. Come to the cabaret. Come taste the wine. Come hear the band. Come blow your horn. Start celebrating. Right this way, your table's waiting. What good's permitting some prophet of doom to wipe every smile away? Life is a cabaret, old chum. So come to the
So that's Liza Minnelli from the film Cabaret, released in 72 and Oscar winner in 73. Sam Wasson is the author of the new biography, Fosse, about Bob Fosse. So what was revolutionary about his work on Cabaret?
Well, you could say, I guess, that he took the movie musical into hell at that point. He, even though there had been the show Cabaret on Broadway, we're talking about the movie musical. And up until that point, most movie musicals were sort of out of date. They were old-fashioned. They didn't really speak to the post-60s feeling of America, which was depressed and angry. You can't really sing about depressed and angry. It's, at least up until that point on film, you couldn't. And Fosse found a perfect idiom, a dance idiom for that, and a cinematic idiom for that. And the culture was ready for it.
Where did he find that idiom?
He found it in his own dark, depressed past. He grew up in these horrible burlesque halls. And it's not burlesque the way we think about burlesque today, which is cute and flirty. I mean, these were really bad, mean places, especially to a kid of 13, which is what...
And especially to the girls who had to work there.
And especially... I mean, it was bad for everyone. And so a lot of these moves come from burlesque through Fosse's unconscious into Cabaret.
Is that what you meant when you said in the book that Fosse was the best thing ever to come from burlesque and he would pay for it forever?
Right. Well, yes, that is what I meant. And what he would pay for forever was the trauma that was done to him as a boy too young to get that kind of sex and despair. Mm-hmm. And you see it throughout his work.
So Cabaret comes out in 72. He wins an Oscar for the film in 73 and then completes the trifecta by winning an Emmy and a Tony.
That's right.
In 73.
Right.
And this should be the pinnacle of his career, and instead it what? It plunges him into depression.
That's right. And I should say he's the only person, I mean, not only to win, but ever to be nominated in these three categories in the same year, which is just a testament to his singular genius. But yes, he goes straight down. And it's hard to understand why someone who should be on the top of the world, you know, feels in the gutter. But Fosse, who always felt like he was fooling them, experienced this as the ultimate in phoniness. Mm. Just confirmation that feeling, that dream of maybe one day feeling legitimate and satisfaction, would never happen. If it didn't happen now, when would he ever feel good, fulfilled?
Did he ever?
With his friends, with Patty Chayefsky, his best friend. They hung out at the Carnegie Deli every day, Patty and Herb Gardner. Those guys really filled him up. Mm. And, of course, sex really filled him up.
Well, you know, it is over 700 pages. And by page 50, I've already, you know, I can't keep track of who he's sleeping with and who he's married and who he's sort of married and had annulled. And, you know, I mean, the parade of women coming and going through his life is pretty bewildering.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's you're dealing with a kind of a Warren Beatty quality record here. Fosse and His Women is worth its own book.
Isn't that this? Isn't that
actually
this book?
he was unstoppable and unbelievable. And one of the things I wanted to capture was the intimate Fosse, which is hopefully not dishy and vulgar. In fact, I really don't think it is. He was a largely tender guy with mm-hmm. women. He just loved sex, and being a straight choreographer really
he kind of
cleaned
stood
up.
Out, stood
yeah.
out from the crowd.
Right,
huh?
right.
All right, we're speaking with Sam Wasson. He's author of this major new biography of Bob Fosse. It is simply called Fosse. We talk a little bit about cabaret. There are many other pieces that he was drawn to that have this kind of darker, this seamy underbelly, and especially like women in Chicago, women in prison and things like that. Women in Trouble seems to have drawn him back to the stage and the screen repeatedly.
Right. Well, he saw Women in Trouble in those burlesque houses. That's what they were all about. Mm-hmm. And so even though he was too old to understand it, you know, like any trauma, it's recorded. It's back there.
So is there a kind of – what does it say about our pop culture that something like cabaret and then Chicago, even perhaps more so, become these sort of pop culture icons, and we view them as sort of, you know, great family entertainment. And really, when you scratch the surface, it's pretty dark stuff.
Well, I think even though cabaret is about the Nazis, it's really about America. And Chicago is too, in the same sense. We use razzle-dazzle. We use show business. Life is a cabaret to cover up what we don't want to see, what hurts us to see.
And you say that razzle-dazzle, that's Fosse's whole kind of ideology summed up there.
You got it. For better and mostly for worse. I mean, I said this is a guy who feels phony. That's what razzle-dazzle is. It's what the phony person uses to try to pull the wool over everyone's eyes.
Give them the old razzle-dazzle. Razzle dazzle 'em. Give 'em an act with lots of flash in it, and the reaction will be passionate. Give 'em the old hocus pocus, bead and feather 'em. How can they see with sequins in their eyes? What if your hinges all are rusting? What if, in fact, you're just disgusting? Razzle dazzle 'em, and they'll never catch wise.
From Chicago, the original cast recording featuring Jerry Orbach with Razzle Dazzle. obviously, this is radio. That's a recording. We can't see what's happened. What was happening on stage?
Well, a huge Hieronymus Bosch-like orgy. It's the trial scene, and the Jerry Orbach character is like Bob Fosse thought he was doing his whole life, is trying to pull the wool over the jury's eyes. If he can entertain them, if he could do his little dance, then he'll draw attention away from the dark and horrible reality of this.
We're speaking with Sam Wasson about his biography of Bob Fosse, called Fosse. He was, as you mentioned earlier, a jack of all trades and a master of quite a few of them, dancer, choreographer, director. He was not a songwriter. So how closely involved in the music end of his musicals could he be?
Well, he had an unbelievably great ear, and that's one of the things that I go into in the book, even though he wasn't, he didn't write the music himself. Like, for instance, the song we just heard, Razzle Dazzle, Kander and Ebb put those finger snaps in because they knew Fosse would go crazy for that. He loved those sort of trick novelty, vaudeville, old-fashioned radio sounds. So his influence is definitely in there. And I think if you look at All That Jazz, the movie All That Jazz, mm-hmm. it is one of the most finely sound-designed films I think probably ever made. I mean that thing is. Go ahead.
Explain what you mean by that, because you don't mean, hey, nice soundtrack, nice score.
No. Although the soundtrack, the score is great. The simplest way I could describe it would be the details. And one of the stories that I tell in the book is when they are recording the trumpet lick at the end of Bye Bye Life, which is the climactic number of All That Jazz, Fosse had him go over it again and again and again and again and again just to make sure it was exactly on the beat. And everyone else was satisfied, although it was 1/24th off to Fosse. That was not enough. And that level of that obsessive attention to detail is one of the things that destroyed his life and made it meaningful.
The film All That Jazz, I mean, this is not just Bob Fosse. This is Bob Fosse about Bob Fosse, right?
Right,
this
right.
is inspired by his heart attack?
Yes, this is as close to Fosse as it gets. It's not the full story, but it's as I say in the book, something like 60%, 100% accurate to 60% of Fosse or something like that. Yes, it's the story of Fosse making Chicago and cutting Lenny at the same time, having his heart attack. And of course, in the movie, Fosse, the Joe Gideon character, dies. Now, amazingly, it's pretty close to how he died in real life. So mm-hmm. he knew. That adds a whole other level of pain and, I think, amazement to the movie.
For all the hundreds of pages in the biography, you could, in fact, just go to page one where the little epigram is, how much time do I have from Bob Fosse? I mean, when did he say that?
He actually said that in the context of making a movie. How much time do I have left to make this movie? How much more money do I have left? Are my resources going out? I mean, this is a guy.
But the way you have it, you know, in the introduction of the book, it's a pretty prophetic statement.
Well, it means the same thing. How much time do I have left to prove that I'm a genius, to try to prove that I'm not phony?
But he was a guy who recognized genius when he saw it in others.
Absolutely. You know, he said, I think one of the definitive Fosse quotes is, Jerome Robbins talks to God. When I call God, he's out to lunch. And of course, people thought Bob was joking, and he was joking. He wanted to make you laugh, but it comes from a real place.
What about Fred Astaire? I mean, the
God.
Yeah.
God.
And
God.
When he first meets Fred Astaire, he's like rooted to the spot. And I think you said he couldn't even like speak, couldn't get a word out.
He was overcome. And when he does run into Fred Astaire, I tell this story in the book on the MGM lot in the 50s. Fred Astaire shakes his hand, says, "Hiya, Foss," and tips his hat and just kicks a nail and walks off. And the nail goes just shooting through the air and rifles off the wall. And Fosse is just demolished by the elegance, just the offhand casual elegance of this gesture, just thrown away as if it means nothing. And of course, to Astaire, it does mean nothing. But to Fosse, it means everything. And he stands there and for probably, you know, upwards of a half an hour, just tries to kick that same nail over and over again and follows it around the lot. And of course, he kicks it like Bob Fosse, which is, to Bob Fosse's mind, not good enough.
So he idolizes Fred Astaire, and I Want to Be a Dancing Man. This meant a lot to him.
Yeah, this is a number that he put. This is a number that Astaire sang, and he used in his show Dancin'. I Want to Be a Dancin' Man While I Can. Again, it's a song that sounds up and cheery, but if you look at the lyrics, you see that this is a song about how much time do I have left.
I wanna be a dancing man while I can. Gonna leave my footsteps on the sands of time. If I never leave a dime, never be a millionaire, I don't care. I'll be rich as old King Midas might have been, at least until the tide comes in. Let other men build mighty nations and buildings to the sky. I'll leave a few creations to show that I was dancing by.
Fred Astaire with I Want to Be a Dancing Man. He meant a lot to Bob Fosse. This song meant a lot to Bob Fosse. Sam, Johnny Mercer's song?
Yeah, Johnny Mercer's song. And it's so much, well, for me, it's so much about the lyrics. I want to leave my footsteps on the sands of time, and then at least until the tide rolls in. Mm-hmm. So the dancer's life, the dancer's work is ephemeral. You see a show, and then it's gone. And the dancer himself or herself only has a couple of great years, and then the dancer is gone. So the idea of death doesn't just haunt Fosse himself. It haunts the very fact of what it means to be a dancer.
Right. Was he ever able to kind of attain Fred Astairedom?
Well, I think there's only one Fred Astaire.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that I find so touching about Fosse is we all want to be some version of Fred Astaire, whether it's a dancer or, in my case, a writer. There are always going to be our gods. And with Fosse, who is one of my gods, to think that my gods have gods, well, it's all very unifying in a way, you know? We're all Salieri and Mozart.
Now, you start the book, Fosse, with the end, with his funeral, you know, the after party to his funeral, essentially. Is that because that scene tells us so much about who Fosse was as a person?
Yeah, I hoped people would see that. One of the reasons I wrote the book was because I think, you know, most of the other writing on Fosse doesn't really show you what a good guy this person really could be and most of the time was.
Yeah.
And
to the point that his wife, his mistress, and his daughter all are dancing together.
There you go. And hundreds of friends. And so I really wanted people to go into this book, which is really going to be about a dark and conflicted guy, understanding that this is a dark and conflicted guy who gave love and received love really to the best of his ability, which wasn't which was limited. But he tried his best. He knew he was limited, and that I found really moving.
And when you say limited, you mean sort of in terms of interpersonal relationships. He seems to have been almost limitless in his ability to, you know, get people to go to give him their best work.
Yes.
As a director.
Yes.
And as a choreographer.
Well, he was a manipulator on stage and off. I mean, that's what a great director is.
So what is his ultimate legacy for you know, the generation of Americans that's grown up since his death? Who is Bob Fosse?
He's the American musical.
All right. That didn't take 800 pages now, did it? Sam Wasson, my guest on Soundcheck. He is the author of the new book, Fosse, and it is, once you get into it, it's really hard to stop reading this book, Sam. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I used to have this girlfriend known as Elsie, with whom I shared four sordid rooms in Chelsea.
If you're looking for the next book to read, head over to soundcheck.org, where we've posted the results of our recent look at great music books by or about women. Find recommendations from Kathleen Hanna, music critics Ann Powers and Jessica Hopper, the Soundcheck staff, and a bunch of our listeners. It's all on our website at soundcheck.org. Coming up next, an in-studio performance from the Denver-based musician Tyler Ludwick, who records under the name Princess Music. That's next on Soundcheck.
You would want me now, a worm inside of me now in the sand. A worthless bag of bones, a worthless prima donna for a friend.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Let me just pull aside the Soundcheck curtain for a moment here. Every week, the staff and I meet to look through the calendar of our upcoming guests, and at some point during our last meeting, I'm looking at who's coming in, and I'm thinking, who or what is Princess Music? Well, happily, I learned that we were not doing a Disney music review. Princess Music is, in fact, a band out of Denver that has released a lovely debut album, but it's in Europe that they've found the most fans, gaining popularity in France, Sweden, and Italy. That in turn led to a successful Kickstarter campaign that allowed Princess Music to record their album called Odo Benede. The band joins me now in the studio to play some of those songs live. Here is Princess Music, live on Soundcheck.
Make the birds to sing, linen limbs to dress in green and clothe the barren portico of a home that houses in its largest room love that's waited long for you. Time that you and your sister drank the water from the feeder for the hummingbirds, oh, red and sweet, like the blood that warms your feet and fills your head with harmony. But I want you for us all. Have a heart so full of light. Wave of white, I know that you know what's right, so trust yourself and leave the night that clothes a barren portico. Of a home that houses in its brittle bones a man who once thought himself better off alone. But I want you for us all to hear the rhythmic beating goal of a heart so full of constellations and light.
That song is called White Wave, and it comes to us from the band Princess Music, live here in the Soundcheck studio. Tyler Ludwick playing guitar and singing, Rachel Slyker on violin, Psyche Duncase playing the cello. Tyler, to you and the rest of Princess Music, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks very much, John. Thanks for having us.
So about that band name, did it occur to you that people trying to Google Princess Music would come up with something very, very different before they ever got to your music?
Actually, no. I would say that, I mean, the name itself formed about 3 or 4 years ago. I hadn't written music or been in any established, nonetheless, bands before then. And so it never really occurred to me that there could be that conflict of interests there. But it was named by one of my best friends at the time. Her name was Brandy. She has she had a 3-year-old niece named Esri, and she named the band for me. And
it sounds like a 3-year-old girl would have named it. I mean, that's kind of when I was looking at the schedule, I was like, Princess Music.
Thinking
back to my own kids when they were like 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. Wow, that would have been a big hit back home.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So I guess you could say we're targeting our audience at a young age.
Well, now, you know, this is not kind of standard songwriting, you know, to electric guitars, bass and drums. Mm-hmm. It's more of a kind of chamber pop thing. You write around the acoustic guitar, right?
Yeah, for the most part. I don't really think I want it to feel that way necessarily, like how it's conveyed sonically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I want it to be very like integrated, all of it, you know.
So there are lots of unusual textures and sounds on the record.
Mm-hmm.
But do you see these as, I mean, is this like a, are they songs written the way most songwriters, you know, jot down some lyrics and a few chords, or do you have stuff kind of notated in a classical way?
So I had actually not really written any lyrics or anything like that. It was the kind of thing where I would play the chord progressions, I would sing the lyrics over and over again to myself until something formulated. Actually, one of the songs on the record, Wounded Walrus, happened as a complete accident. Those words just came out because they alliterated. That's the actual process of writing the songs themselves. In terms of the orchestration around it, I make it a point to write everything by hand, so just pen and paper for me. More so, I think, just as an exercise for myself to try and, I guess, connect with the way that I think someone's brain had to work back in the day, you know, before it was easy to just sort of plug it into a, you know, notation software program or something and hear what you're doing. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that whatsoever, that was my own personal, like, it was sort of like an anachronism.
So you have some classical music training. You're able to do that with paper and pen.
Yeah, which I went to music school for 3 semesters, so, you know, for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. I made it through Music Theory 3, took, like, 1 form and analysis class, 1 composition class, and, like I said, I think that desire to even develop that skill just lied dormant until I was about 22 and I started writing.
So a lot of the songs on this record, the record called Odo Benede, if you go online, you can find instrumental versions of most of them. So is that basically how it starts? You do the instrumental stuff first and then the lyrics come later?
No, actually. For this particular record, a lot of these songs, this was kind of just a batch of songs that I had around. Some of them are upwards of like 2 years old.
Oh, okay.
Some of them I had written last year. So they vary in terms of age,
right?
I guess.
And the title of the album, Odo Benedei, that's clearly a Latin name, looks like, you know, from biology or something.
Yeah, it's the walrus. Odo Benus rosmarus is the binomial nomenclature of it. And it's the only surviving member of the Odo Benedei family.
The walrus is.
Yeah, the walrus is, one which I think is probably a little known fact. But
okay. So Odo Benedei is Latin for I am the walrus, is what you're telling
sure,
me.
Sure, yeah. That's exactly what it means. Yeah.
So why a walrus?
I guess it happened as a result of the accident.
That you were talking about before,
yeah,
the wounded walrus.
Exactly.
Song.
It goes back. And I had, like I said, I'd accidentally said those two words together when trying to create lyrics. And for some reason I was like, no, I don't want to say that. Like that's ridiculous. That's such a strange image to have in your head when, you know, singing a song, but, it actually started to kind of grow on me. Mm. And that imagery, for as strange as it may seem, I think to have within the context of a song, to me personally, it paints a very strong image.
Let's hear that song. Again, it's Princess Music, live on Soundcheck, with Wounded Walrus.
Wounded walrus, you have yet to make your peace with me before you slip into the blue below. Whisper this to me, 'cause you know that I'd kiss the sadness from your eyes if you let me in. Odo Benedei, you've got to put that piece away before you hurt yourself or someone else. It happens to be in your way. You say you sit alone and face the night, but I think it's dawn in your eyes, so wake up. Say you sit alone and face the night, but I think it's dawn in your eyes, so wake
Wounded Walrus, the name of that song, from the band Princess Music out of Denver, but here in our New York studio on Soundcheck. And you heard the title of the album as part of the lyrics there, Odo Benedei, the family name of the group of animals that includes the walrus. Once again, Tyler Ludwig singing and playing guitar, Rachel Slyker on violin, Psyche Duncase playing cello, live here in the Soundcheck studio. Tyler, why do you think so much of your SoundCloud, your online listening, has come from Europe?
That's a really good question, actually. I mean, I've thought about it, and I don't know why. I mean, it was the kind of thing where my manager Mark and I, we had decided to check it one day, and you know, if you upgrade to the best version of SoundCloud, you can obviously you can see stats and whatnot, and,
right?
You know, it had reached, you know, the 40,000 plays or whatever on SoundCloud Mark on of the single White Wave that we had put out like maybe a year ago now, actually, which is a long time ago, but and surprisingly it was close to half of those plays were all from Italy.
Italy?
Yeah, Italy of all places. And
okay.
Yeah. And then, you know, we got a few really kind write ups from some French blogs that were really into it, and yeah.
So I guess they like their walruses in Italy.
I guess they do.
Their yeah. walry or whatever the plural whatever the plural form is.
Walrusi.
So have you done a lot of this kind of thing where it's just, you know, the three of you with just the small ensemble? Because you tend to write bigger productions on the record.
Right, yeah. No, we don't really ever do this. This is our first time. This is our first legitimate performance. Well, I can't say that. We performed for Rachel's family the other night.
That's legitimate.
Yeah, but this is our first time really going for it. And I mean, obviously we've been practicing some, just trying to make the songs still feel full and filled out in this configuration. But it's really nice. I like it. I think we can all agree that it makes us listen to each other a lot more, and that it's just really good. And we're normally a 5-piece band.
Yeah.
We have drums and bass and all this stuff like that. But no, this is a great exercise for us. And it's true. I mean, for the release show that we had on August 9th for the record, we had a full 16-piece chamber orchestra playing with us and everything. So that was huge.
Thanks to a successful Kickstarter campaign.
That's right.
Fan funding, allowing you to hire the essentially a chamber orchestra.
That's right.
to write these to perform these songs. The album is called Odo Bene Dei. It is out now. They've been playing for us live in the Soundcheck studio. And guys, thank you so much for coming in and playing for us.
Thank you, John.
Up next, why some users of cochlear implants have trouble hearing music and what researchers are doing to improve the hearing devices. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Since the 1970s, more than 200,000 deaf adults and children have received cochlear implants, and it's made hearing and sometimes even speech possible for those who've received them. But it might surprise you to learn that the current cochlear implant technology doesn't really allow for hearing music. Joining me now by phone from Johns Hopkins University is Dr. Charles Lim, an associate professor of otolaryngology and a faculty member at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. Charles, nice to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
So how is it possible to hear speech but not music?
It's a pretty fascinating question when you think about it. When you look at the acoustics of speech or spoken language, and then you compare them to music, what becomes clear right away is that music is a much more complicated stimulus. Actually, speech tends to be fairly redundant, which is why we can hear things like computerized speech on a telephone, you know, or a cell phone pretty readily. We can understand what's being spoken, even if the sound quality is not so good. Now, with music, that sort of function deteriorates rather quickly, and if you try to listen to music that's very degraded, it really stops sounding like the musical signal you want to hear.
Right. So I think probably most people think that if you're someone who's deaf or had profound hearing loss and you get one of these cochlear implants, you turn the thing on and suddenly all's right with the world, but it seems like maybe the technology is not quite there yet.
Right, and I wish it were the case that that was how easy it would be. And we go through a pretty extensive counseling process with every patient to make sure that their expectations for what is going to take place following the surgery are reasonable. You know, this is not one of those technologies that you can just sort of turn on and expect that the brain will react to instantaneously.
Right.
And so it's as much the technology as it is the brain trying to relearn how to hear again.
So, I mean, both speech and music are built around rhythm. And, of course, there are some languages like Chinese where they're built around tone as well. But is rhythm something that even the current technology can handle?
So of those two properties, if you look at music and sound from a time dimension and then a pitch or a frequency dimension, or what we call a spectral dimension, it turns out that implants are much better at the time dimension than they are at the spectral dimension.
Mm-hmm.
What that implies for music is that things like rhythm are relatively well preserved in a cochlear implant, whereas things like pitch tend to be almost severely deteriorated for many listeners.
Right. Now, what we have here is a demonstration from a research company called Sensometrics. It includes an actual sample of music, and then we'll hear what it sounds like through one of these cochlear implants. We're speaking with Dr. Charles Lim, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at Johns Hopkins and a faculty member at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. So, Charles, nice piece of music, you know, little cafe-style ensemble, and then it becomes this kind of, I don't know what, horror film soundtrack there.
Kind of goth, if you ask me.
Why does that happen?
Well, I think you can tell from the transition that the simulation is showing you the limits to a certain extent of the technology to differentiate not only between the actual pitches being heard. There's kind of a blurring of the pitches where the sort of the resolution. So normally when you look at a piano keyboard, you see this kind of semitone resolution from one key to the next, and you expect in a normal listener that when you go up and down the piano keyboard that every note should sound different from the one next to it.
Right.
But that's not quite the case for a cochlear implant user because they don't have such fine-grained pitch discrimination. So what you see is that many notes on a piano keyboard are essentially fused into the same note.
Right.
So there's this kind of pitch fusion that's taking place. The other important thing that's happening is that the sound quality is changing such that the instruments are not really recognizable the way you would have expected. And so this is a property called timbre. And timbre refers to what we call tone color, or the ability to identify a musical instrument or differentiate one from the other when they're playing the same note at the same volume. And so timbre is severely distorted in most cochlear implant users. So in this example that we're listening to in the simulation, it's very hard to tell what instruments are playing what.
Yeah. So does it make a difference if the person getting the implant is someone who had normal hearing at some point in their life and then lost it? As opposed to someone who has been deaf from birth?
It appears to make a huge difference. Now, there's, I think, two sides to that question. One is that if you had normal hearing, and let's say you're an adult and you lose your hearing and then you obtain a cochlear implant, all of your brain centers are in place and ready to kind of receive sound. And so you have the central auditory network already present to be able to help you with that task.
So you're wired. You're wired already for sound.
Correct. Exactly. And you also have memories of what music used to sound like to kind of guide you in your interpretations. That being said, you also have expectations for how music should sound. And
so to
some extent, it might be harder to accept the idea that when you're listening to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony that it just sounds horrible to you.
Right.
It's no longer Ode to Joy. It's Ode to something else. And now, with somebody who's born deaf and receives a cochlear implant at birth, it's a very interesting and different situation because they've never heard normal music, so to speak. And so their entire concept of what music sounds like is through the implant. And so there's no expectation, there's no memory to compare it to. And so they sort of evaluate it for what they're hearing it as. And that, in some cases, is fruitful because there are some subjects that they like it fine. I mean, they might not be hearing it the same way you would. It's sort of like viewing art through a filter. I mean, it still might be interesting and engaging to you, even if it's not what the original stimulus was intended to be or what a normal hearing listener would hear. Now, if you lost your hearing at birth and you were implanted as an adult, that's where you really struggle with something like music, because not only have you had no concept of what music should sound like, your brain also has not been wired to process that sound. And so that's probably the most challenging situation.
Right. I know an otolaryngologist who was telling me a couple of months ago that they've stopped doing implants for people who were, you know, born deaf or lost their hearing as infants, past a certain age, like past the age of 30, they just don't want to do it because it, you know, the wiring is not there in the brain, and it can be a almost painful experience for those people when it's turned on because they just don't know how to process the sounds.
Outcomes are certainly poorer for that population, but I think that, you know, it's a personal decision, and a lot goes into it. And so the way we kind of approach it, or the way I have approached it, is by having basically a very in-depth, personalized conversation with each candidate to figure out what their goals are, what their expectations are, and what they really hope that this procedure or this technology will do for them. And then we take it from there.
All right. Now, Charles, you're aware of this research at the University of Washington, where they've developed a new algorithm for these cochlear implants, with the idea of allowing the users to hear pitch and timbre, the very things that you've been saying are so difficult for people with these implants now. What do you think of that research?
So I'm very familiar with the research, and I'll tell you that so Dr. Jay Rumstein, who's the senior author on that study, is a really brilliant scientist and has done some truly important work in terms of understanding how cochlear implant users hear not only music but also speech. And so I think that the study is really important because it suggests that tailoring the processing strategy towards music rather than towards speech may actually lead to beneficial outcomes for music. Now, that sounds self-evident, but it's not been the way the field has gone, meaning that so far the field has been really dominated by the goal of language. And that, right. You know, that makes sense.
Sure,
if you were
sure.
deaf, yeah, if you lose your hearing and you get an implant, you want to be able to hear speech. Now what we're seeing is that maybe if we design an implant so that you can hear music, that would sort of enable you to hear everything.
Hmm. So even people who, you know, are getting the implant to be able to hear speech, it's still hard for them if they're in a noisy room, if there are multiple conversations going on. So what you're suggesting is that a sort of musically oriented cochlear implant will enable people to pick out speech in those environments as well?
That's exactly what I'm suggesting. See, I think speech is, it's actually too easy of a signal to serve as a useful end goal for all users. We need to raise our standard to something that's more difficult than speech. And music might be that standard where if you can hear music, you might be able to hear anything.
Right.
And I think that's also why difficult listening conditions like a restaurant or listening in noise with a, you know, noisy background, that is where we start to see performance decline because it's too difficult for the implant to process. And so I think this research is brilliant in that it suggests that algorithmic processing strategies that are tailored towards timbre or pitch might actually impact positively our ability to hear a musical instrument.
We're speaking with Dr. Charles Lim from Johns Hopkins University. He's also a musician on the faculty at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. Now, this University of Washington research team, led by Jay Rubenstein and Les Atlas, has put together a demonstration. First, let's hear this clip of music as it sounds normally. All right, just a couple of notes on the cello. Now, here's how it sounds if you're listening through a cochlear implant. As Charles was saying, the notes all sort of squish together so you don't hear the melody. Here's the same set of notes through this new algorithm for the cochlear implant. So, Charles, it's not quite Beethoven yet, but you're beginning to get a hint of the differentiation between the different notes.
Absolutely, and also the sound, the timbre of the sound is starting to emerge a little bit more clearly.
Yeah.
You know, these implants are out of tune, they're out of pitch, and the tone color is incorrect. And so we're slowly starting to get them in tune and to get the tone color to be correct, and this is an important step in that direction.
And another important thing to note is that the sort of adjustment of the cochlear implant is done on the external part. It doesn't require more surgery, right?
Correct. Now, every once in a while, somebody does have to have another procedure or there are, you know, internal processor upgrades, but for now, what we're talking about is an external sound processing strategy change.
Mm-hmm. So for people who do currently have cochlear implants, is there a type of music that might potentially be best for them, something that, you know, especially for those people whose brains are still kind of wiring themselves to accept that kind of stimulus?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think that as a general idea, rhythmic music, meaning music that has very high, strong emphasis on rhythmic patterns, would be something that an implant user would gravitate towards. The other thing is that maybe the music itself needs to be simpler. And what I mean by that is it just may be something like a symphony orchestra is too complicated for someone with an implant user to hear well, and that you need to sort of listen to kind of a reduction of that orchestra. And so there's this idea that music for cochlear implant listeners should be different, even in terms of the original composition, than for somebody who's listening with normal hearing.
Hmm. So if you're listening to sort of contemporary music, it seems like maybe electronic dance music would be okay for people listening through these implants.
You know, a lot of kids do really like dance and hip-hop music with implants. It's very true.
And are we, at the end of the day, Charles, are we talking about a quality of life issue here? I mean, it's great that, you know, someone who couldn't hear now can hear. But, you know, to be able to give them some inkling of the joys of listening to music, that strikes me as a quality of life issue.
Sure, in the sense that you're not going to die if you're deaf. Now, that being said, if you've never been deaf, I don't think you can underestimate the impact of what that has on your life. I mean, imagine if you've had a life full of sound and then all of a sudden complete silence.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a trivial thing. It's a widespread problem, and, you know, one of the major reasons for cognitive decline and also for things like depression. And so I would suggest that it's a quality of life issue in the most important sense, is that our ability to hear is so linked to who we are, how we experience life, and kind of how we view the future.
Yeah, and so this new research at the University of Washington, really very promising stuff, and we've been discussing it with Dr. Charles Lim, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at Johns Hopkins and on the faculty of the Peabody Conservatory of Music. Charles, really nice speaking with you again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Coming up on Monday's show, the writer Ann Patchett has given us novels like Bel Canto and State of Wonder and a new collection of essays called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. On Monday, Ann Patchett gives us three of her favorite songs in a Pick 3 playlist. Also, the rise of ad dollars in indie rock. And the British vocal trio Juice performs a song by Guns N' Roses and some other music live in our studio. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.